Hi guys, and welcome back to another episode with us, Girls Talk Crime. I'm Jenny.
I'm Amy.
And I'm Georgia.
So I had a really embarrassing thing happen to me this week.
I did pass out in a car park. Don't know what happened to me then, but if the person who was there is actually listening, I apologise for passing out in a car park.
And shitting all over myself.
Pissing my pants.
And thank you for not kidnapping Jenny, and we're not doing this episode on a Where's Jenny?
Yeah. Missing. Guys, in all seriousness, if I went missing, please pick a nice photo. Like, obviously it needs to look like me.
Nope.
So maybe don't use that with a Snapchat filter. But for example, the one you just took a screenshot of my frozen face on Skype, don't use that.
I know the first picture I'd use, Jenny. The afro one. The Home Alone picture with you as Merv. Just popping in on the side.
Yeah, well, do you know, actually, I wouldn't mind if they get published. We can put them on our Instagram.
We need to do a Halloween special of that picture.
Oh, yeah.
I could be like the...
When a stranger calls and it just be Jenny in the background.
You know the scene in Psycho when she gets in the shower?
That's a play with that later.
So what that was, you know, just if anyone actually cares out there, is I decided to do one of those, you know, you see on Instagram a little video of someone doing something to their hair. So it was a girl and she was doing non-heat curling, but she got like bits of material and wrapped her hair around it and slept in it, and she woke up and she had this beautiful like beach waved hair. Now I've got very frizzy curly hair. I did it, I took it out, and my hair is quite short as well, so I just literally had afro of blonde hair, and I couldn't even get a hairbrush through it. It was so matted. And the guys just went on and, what would you say, superimposed the picture of me with my afro onto
famous. We photoshopped you onto like everything. The best one being Home Alone.
Amy gave me a birthday card, and it was literally like an A2 birthday card with that picture on.
You wait until you get the canvas of that fucking picture on it. Oh,
cannot wait in my little meagre bedroom at my mum and dad's house.
I will frame that and have it above my bed.
Would you? Oh, Christmas presents done.
Massive, though. I want it to be huge. Huge. And I will laugh every time I go to sleep.
You know, in that like pop art style when there's one black and white, one sepia, one crazy colour and a normal one in like a little block of floor. This week, guys, we're going to mix it up a little bit. We're going to do two stories. The first part of today's episode will be a true crime murder story. And the second part will be a creepy pasta. So pull your socks up and get ready to be scared.
Our story takes us to the 22nd of September 2006 in Pocatello, Idaho, USA. Cassie Jo Stoddart arranged with her auntie and uncle to house sit their large American home. This was not the first time Cassie had sat at the house, and this was for a few days, mainly to look after the animals in the home. Cassie did not want to be alone while looking after this home, so Cassie's mother reluctantly agreed to allow her boyfriend, Matt Beckham, to accompany her, but the rule was to have no one else come around. So basically, no house parties. Around 8 p.m, Cassie and Matt settled down for the evening to watch TV and eat junk food. Come 8:15 p.m, there was a ring at the door. Clueless and freaked out, Cassie looked at Matt, who then explained he had invited two friends round from school.
So let's backtrack a second. Who is Cassie? Cassie is a 16-year-old school student from Pocatello High School. She is pretty, popular, and is aspiring to be a veterinarian or an attorney, which is, I believe, a lawyer in England or America. No, hang on, wait. I got confused. Is lawyer an American or That's an American term, isn't it? And are we attorneys?
Solicitors.
Okay. That's it. Matt Beckham also attends the same high school and, as was popular for 16-year-olds, had an interest in filmmaking. It was the interest in filmmaking that brings us to how Cassie and Matt know who is ringing the doorbell at 8:15 on the 22nd of September 2006.
Matt opens the front door and lets in Brian Lee Draper and Tori Michael Adamczyk. These boys are both friends with Cassie and Matt, especially Matt due to their filmmaking interests, such as we said before. Both boys, Brian and Tori, were also 16 and went to Pocatello High School. They, however, were not popular. They kept themselves to themselves and spent most of their time making home movies and listening to music.
That sounds like us.
Does sound like us. The now group of four, Cassie, Matt, Brian and Tori, sat down in the living room and watched a film. No doubt a horror film, I'm going to say, because what else you do when you're 16? After 1 hour, Brian and Tori decided that they were bored of watching the film and they were going to head down to Pocatello Cinema instead. I assume to watch another film, I guess. Get bored of this film. Gonna go and watch another film. Cassie and Matt are once again alone, what Cassie's mother had wanted. So I'm sure Cassie felt relieved that they had been left alone and she wouldn't get into trouble for going against the rules that her mum had set.
So picture this. You're sitting in a large house watching a film. The whole rest of the house is quiet, except for maybe a few dogs' footsteps. I know my dog walks around in the night and it's like, what the fuck is that noise? Then I realise it's like the dog's tail like banging against the wall or something.
Little toenails clipping along the floor.
Yeah. Like through the night.
It sounds like a draw.
Cassie and Matt started to hear strange light noises. So maybe it's an old house and they could hear creaks, obviously the animals again, or even noises outside. But then the light started to flick. Not flicker and not cut out completely, but turn on and off repeatedly. So obviously they were scared. They slowly both moved around the house and headed towards the basement, because obviously the basement is where the fuse box would be.
Of course.
Fuck off. I'm sorry. If the lights were flickering in my house and I had to go to a basement, I would literally just go to like a 24-hour Tesco and wait out until morning.
Jen, you'd be like, let the dogs die. Bye.
I'm sorry. I would leave Jackson in the house if the lights were flickering. Girl would be out of there.
I don't even think I would live in a house or house at a house where they had a basement.
No, I
don't. We don't do basements in the UK.
When you say basement, though, if you go to, like, basements in America and it is a big house, they're often, like, kitted out, like, normal rooms just without windows. In a lot of them, like, my friend Chris, again, shout out. her basement is just, like, a living room downstairs. Mm. It's not actually that freaky, but when us lot picture a basement, we think of, like, crickety, like, wooden shitty steps and a creaky banister. One of those little pull-down lights, you know, that flickers and you just smash it.
like the basement in Home Alone. That's what I think of.
Yeah. You think of something creepy like that. Or in The Conjuring.
Also, a little bit going off on the tangent, but to either of you, when you have to turn the light off downstairs to go upstairs, I know in my house, like when you turn it off, there's like another light that you'd put on at the top of the stairs. Do you fucking peg it?
Oh, every day.
Turn it off. And then you envisage someone like pulling you down the stairs. You like do it and you do this like shitty like run it all the way up the stairs.
Do you not have a light at the top and at the bottom that controls the same light?
No, I do at the bottom but not at the top.
Oh wow, you guys fuck them, because I go downstairs, I can turn off the light and then go upstairs and turn off the same light, so I'm fine. I don't have to run anywhere. I literally every room I walk into I can turn the light on and then go to the other side of the room and turn back off again.
I refuse to look into my kitchen at night. Like, if I'm going upstairs, I will run upstairs and I refuse to look into the kitchen because I don't want to look outside the patio doors. So I, like, run up really fast because I'm like, I don't want to see. Like, because obviously I said it before in a previous podcast, I do have a really good imagination. I can just picture something there.
Yeah.
Like, I just fuck it up those stairs so fast. Back to the story, because we do love a tangent. Matt's mobile phone rings and Matt answers. The light comes back on, and this time it stays on. On the phone is Matt's mum. She had found out that Matt was intending to stay round with Cassie, just the two of them, and she did not like this. My mum was a lot more chill on this, as long as I wasn't alone.
She'd rather me be with someone.
But hey ho. But to be honest, at the end of the day, they are teenagers. Matt's mum tells him to come home. Matt explains about the weird goings on in the home, but she's not having any of it. You know, she'd be like, oh, for fuck's sake, you're just chatting shit. You just want to get your willy wet. Come home, son. But she, you know. But she does, you know, say she can take Cassie home or Cassie can stay with them, but she doesn't want them staying in an empty house alone. At this point, Cassie assumed the light being off before and it's now on, it was just a power cut, and she's sure she would be okay on her own. She was still looking after her auntie's pets. So at 11 p.m, Matt's mum comes to pick up Matt. Cassie is now alone. Or so she thinks. Cassie goes back into the living room and carries on watching the film. Moments later, the lights start to turn on and off again. Cassie needs to sort the lights. So she again slowly wanders around the house towards the basement.
Meanwhile, walking up the stairs are two murderers dressed in plain clothing with white masks that they had covered in fake blood. They were heading towards Cassie. The attack took place back in the living room. Cassie was taken by surprise, then chased and hunted by these two killers. Of course, being frightened for her life and out of pure fear, she was defending herself from these two killers with knives. They stabbed Cassie over 30 times with a mixture of stabs and slashes. It took a day before Cassie was found by her cousin, followed by her auntie and uncle. And it was at this moment that Cassie's mother had to come to the house due to not being able to contact Cassie. 911 was called and the murder investigation was to start.
At the scene, there was no forced entry that would explain an attempted burglary, but there was broken glass down in the basement next to a broken window. Another eerie clue was the open door of the fuse box. There had been no power cut. The killer had tried to lure the victims down into the basement by faking one, and the killer was actually turning the lights on and off. Could Matt, Cassie's boyfriend, be involved in this attack? No. Matt was cleared. Matt had an alibi from his mother, and he also passed a polygraph test with flying colours. But what about Brian and Tori? They were taken in for questioning and were asked to explain their whereabouts for the whole evening. They told police they had seen a mysterious white van when they had left the house.
Meanwhile, detectives found out they never attended the cinema, but they said they went to see a film. A detective caught Brian out. The detective asked what happened in the film. Brian said he wasn't really paying attention, so he wasn't sure. So the detective had then said, you know, you need to remember because it needs to secure you an alibi, which helps you out in the case. The detective also explained he went to see the film. The detective was actually chuckling. He'd seen the film, so he was trying to catch him out. At this point, Brian changed his story and said that they'd actually been trying to open car doors around the area to try and get inside to get the belongings. He called this going through cars. Meanwhile, after detectives quizzing Tori on his knives, he requested an attorney.
Police had a call from Brian's parents. Brian wanted to confess. He told police that it was supposed to be an innocent prank, but it went wrong, and Tori did all of the stabbing and got carried away. However, the stab wounds on Cassie's body were inflicted by two different knives, so it's very unlikely that it was just Tori that inflicted these wounds. Brian led police to Black Rock Canyon, where the following items that belonged to Brian and Tori were found. Bloody clothing. Two terrifying masks that had been inspired by the band Slipknot. Or Sipknot.
Sipknot. I'm just trying to think of what masks they wore in Slipknot. I can't remember. But they wear different ones. But I can't say when I listened to them when I was younger, because I did listen to them when I was younger, that I actually took any notice on what they were wearing on their face.
I used to hate it, actually. Andrew used to quite like Slipknot, or Sipknot. And he had loads of posters in his room, and I used to hate going up there, because I was wondering, it was a clown one covered in blood. Horrified me. Anyway, two bloody knives and a videotape. All of these items had been doused with hydrogen peroxide, ready to be burnt. But this was unsuccessful, so it was just buried. Police had all the evidence that they needed, and this videotape would secure a conviction.
There should be no law against killing people. I know it's a wrong thing, but hell, you restrict somebody from it, they're gonna want it more.
We found our victim and
sad as it may be, she's our friend. But you know what? We all have to make sacrifices. Our first victim is going to be Cassie Stoddard. She's going to be alone in a big, dark house out in the middle of nowhere. How perfect can you get? I mean, like, holy shit, dude.
I'm horny just thinking about it.
Hell yeah.
They even had footage of the day before the murder. This was plotting the events that were to take place that evening. They even spoke about a kill list for future victims. And even Matt, who was with Cassie that night, was on it. He was actually supposed to die that night with Cassie, but his mum saved his life.
Good old mum.
9:50, September 22nd, 2006. We know there's lots of doors. There's lots of places to hide. I locked the back doors. That's all I locked.
It turns out when they supposedly left to go to the cinema, they went to one of their cars. They changed their clothes, grabbed their masks and weapons. They proceeded to enter the house through the basement, which Matt does recall hearing a sound of glass hitting the floor. They would turn the lights on and off to try and lure the victims into the basement, making the kill simple. This was interrupted by Matt's mum. So the boys waited for Matt to leave and started their plan all over again, trying to bait Cassie down into the basement. Eventually, they go in for the attack, chasing Cassie, then brutally stabbing her.
I just killed Cassie. We just left her house. This is not a fucking joke.
I'm shaking.
I stabbed her in the throat and I saw her lifeless body just disappear. Dude, I just killed Cassie. Oh, fuck. That felt like fucking real. I mean, it went by so fast.
Shut the fuck up. We gotta get our act straight.
Okay.
So the nature of these killings was just like the film Scream, the classic 90s slasher film. They also wanted to be famous, like the attack on Columbine, and they had also attempted over 10 other hits, but because these victims were not home alone, they were unsuccessful. They even apologised to Cassie's family before the murder via videotape. And on the videotape, which they record in the library at the school, they said that she was a target because she was pretty.
At school, they recorded this.
So there's clips of them mainly in school recording it in different areas. A bit like Columbine, to be fair, because they were recording their videos around the school and then kind of in their back gardens and stuff. And then the main recordings that you'll see like all over the internet is outside Cassie's house and in their vehicle driving away.
So really, this could have all been stopped, couldn't it, if someone had overheard them? But then even if a teacher or another classmate overheard them, would they just think it was kids being kids and sort of just saying shit? Oh, fuck, I'm going to go. Yeah, this weekend I'm going to fuck them up. Oh, you know, kind of like lad talk.
Yeah. And I've seen in the video, they've kind of got their heads on the table and they're whispering. So you can only just about hear what they're saying. And they're looking around because they know not to be heard, but they obviously want to record.
Okay. Also, imagine, because that would come out, wouldn't it? It would come out in your school that had happened and who it was. And imagine knowing that your name, finding out that your name is on the list.
Yeah. And they've had interviews of people that were on the list. But if there's 10 possible people it could have been. And because their mum was home, their dad was home, friend was over, sister was there. That's what stopped them from being attacked.
Brian and Tori received life without the chance of parole at the age of just 16. And both Brian and Tori are still in prison and will be probably nearly 30 now.
Yeah, they would be.
And no chance of parole either. So they are going to be in there forever. Which they should be, quite frankly.
Yeah, you plan just like a little, just for the sake of a film and becoming famous. You're not right in the head at all.
I don't get it. I know teenagers, we all had maybe done weird things as teenagers that we look back on and think, why did I do that? And why was I so concerned about, you know, that particular thing? But I think you have to be a special type of person to think, actually, I'm going to kill someone and be famous for murdering someone, because your life will be over regardless.
Your friends as well, that they were all friends.
Yeah.
Do you reckon it's a jealousy thing?
Oh yeah. I think like they were friends but they didn't like them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, status.
Do you guys think that story was a bit creepy? Does that creep you out a little bit?
It definitely gives me scary movie vibes, 100%. It's your classic, there's a killer in a basement, isn't it? Or all the lights go off, better check the basement. It's classic horror, but in a true format, sadly for Cassie.
Those boys could have carried on and continued with their plan.
But now you say that, there was actually another female I'm not sure how long before it was, but she also was murdered by being violently stabbed, but it was never solved. But how this kind of went down, I think it'd be very unlikely it was them that did that.
Yeah, they're not smart enough to get away with it.
No, I don't think so.
And they had unless they had a separate recording, because I would have thought if they recorded this, they would have recorded anything else they would have done. They never found evidence, but someone did it.
One of them was more messed up than the other, and they'd used it as a practice run.
Could be. You might be onto something there, Duck.
Yeah, because whose dad was it? He called the Brian. So maybe it was Tori. Maybe Tori was the more fucked up one, and he went out without Brian.
Brian's the one that confessed first, and it kind
of. Or maybe Brian was clever enough to be the first one to say he did it, so it looked more like he did it rather than. Do you know what I mean? If he tells the police what they want to know, then he'll get lesser than the other person.
The old switcheroo. The old deception.
The old switcheroo.
I'm not going to be running downstairs in the dark anytime soon, I tell you that.
That's why I sleep with the fan on, though, so I don't hear noises and don't go and investigate. I sleep with the fan on at night so I don't have to worry about shit like that. Helps drown out the scary.
I had scaffolding on quite a while back, and you know the scaffolding big signs, and it was moving around in the wind, and it made noises, and it's literally like, you know, is it signs when the aliens are running around the roof?
Oh, fuck, yeah.
I couldn't sleep at all that night because I thought someone was like running around my roof, but I was too scared to get out of bed. Dan's pretending he couldn't hear it. I knew he could hear it. He's like, I can't hear nothing. I was like, I know you can hear that because I can hear it. And he's like, don't know what you're on about. Go to sleep. He's fine. He's probably like shitting himself, like quivering.
Noah, have a look out the window for me, mate.
I was going to say.
That is the scariest bit in Signs, isn't it? When she's like, there's someone outside my room or outside my window. And then he's like, oh, you're fine. And then he looks around and sees someone on the roof. You're like, oh my God, fuck that.
Oh, I know. Can we still talk about this now?
But this is our scary true story. Jenny, we need our scary fiction story.
Well, the thing is, even though it's fiction, I reckon it might have a little bit of truth behind it. Ooh. So we'll leave that for you to adapt. So let's get ready for our first ever creepypasta.
Okay, so with a little follow-on from that case, we thought we'd wrap up today's episode with a creepypasta. Now, for those who don't know what a creepypasta is, it's a short fiction story that is self-published on the internet, mainly in places like Reddit. I particularly found this one on a YouTube channel called Creepy McPasta, and then the YouTube channel just sort of links them below, and then you look them up that way. So the one I have found for today's episode is one titled "We had to make up scary stories in class. One stood out from the rest." The link will be in the description of today's episode if you do fancy reading it. I have pretty much read it word for word, but this is just something we thought we would try to mix it up a bit so we're not just solely, you know, sticking to true crime stories, especially at this time of year. Something to freak you out. And if you do enjoy this, then let us know and we can make you and we can possibly make this more of a regular thing in our episodes. Enjoy. We had to make up scary stories to tell in class. This one stood out from the rest. Back when I was in primary school, we had a teacher that everyone hated. Mr. Hanscom was his name, and he taught English. Mr. Hanscom was probably about 5'5", with a ratty face, thick glasses, fat little pot belly, losing his hair on top, pretty much every generic disadvantage you could think of, all rolled into this one asshole. Fuck. I hated him. I don't know if the power of being taller than over 30 humans in one classroom went to this guy's head, but he treated us more like prisoners rather than English students. He yelled and screamed at the kids. He humiliated them. He'd put you into detention for anything he could think of. He was nasty. Nasty piece of work. He had his favourites too. Not the kids he liked, but the kids he particularly liked to pick on. There was an overweight boy called John Pickard, for instance. And every time Hanscom took the register, he'd call him P.
pig arse and act like it was all a big mistake. Always made him read the part of Piggy when we studied Lord of the Flies. There was a girl called Mary Richards who had a lisp. Whenever there was no volunteers to read out loud, he'd make Mary do it every time. But the kid he loved picking on most of all was Grant. Grant was the new kid who joined us at the start of year six. Mum told me he was a traveller, which meant that he moved to lots of different places and lived in a caravan. The other kids at school had different names for him. They never said them to Grant's face. The kid was about a head taller than the rest of us. For one, big boned and broad, he had a steely, don't fuck with me look upon his face, which meant the other kids left him alone. It didn't stop Mr. Hanscom though. Not one bit. I don't know whether it was because Grant was almost as tall as him, or because Grant's family were travellers, but Hanscom had marked him from day one. He hated Grant. You could hear it in his voice every time he spoke to him. He did not like this kid one bit. Mr. Hanscom alternated between telling Grant off in front of everyone. This could be for literally anything, like sneezing while Hanscom was talking, having his shirt untucked, and trying his best to embarrass the kid. The first week, he had Grant come up to the front of the class and he berated him for about 10 minutes because his shoes weren't properly polished. Another time, he told us we were going to practice simonyms. Then he wrote the word different in the middle of the blackboard. We all had to take turns going up and writing words around it that meant a similar sort of thing. But when we were done, Mr. Hanscom gave a thin smile. Now, I need someone who's well-versed in the subject to volunteer to read out all these words to the class, he said. What about you, Grant? I think he'd been expecting Grant to be a slow reader, but he was wrong. The kid might have looked like a thug, but boy, could he read. He rattled through those words with no problem at all, never giving any hint that the subject matter affected him. I could see Hanscom's smile slowly turning into a scowl the longer it went on. Things carried on in the same vein for most of the autumn term, Hanscom needling and Grant putting up with it as best as he could. But then in October, we had a special assignment. One for Halloween. The idea was to go away and write a scary story so that we could take turns reading them out loud to the class on October the 31st. I don't remember many of the stories that the other kids told that day. I barely even remember my own. But I think it was something pretty generic about a monster in the cupboard of my room. But I remember Grant's. Even all these years later, I still remember it. The story Grant told was a sort of folksy tale, and it had me hooked from the moment he began. Here it is, in Grant's words, or as best as I can remember them. Once upon a time, there was a family of witches who lived in a nearby cave. The witches kept to themselves, and most of the people and the creatures in the nearby village left them well alone. But there was one exception. A large, ugly troll terrorised the woods and the surrounding village. The troll was 8 feet tall, with a big green belly the size of a boulder. Hideous red boils and warts covered his face. He ate anything that was foolish enough to get in his way. Now the troll thought he owned the woods, and didn't like the fact that the witches were living in the cave so close to them. He didn't like it at all. But there wasn't much he could do about it. Whenever he'd see the witches, he'd give chase, but they'd always run back to the safety of their cave. They'd crawl back into the darkness between the rocks, and the troll was too big to follow them. He'd stand at the mouth of the cave, and he'd bellow the same thing every day. Witches hiding in the cracks, leave this land and don't come back. If you refuse and choose to stay, know that I will make you pay. Now the witches were afraid of the troll, everyone was, but they didn't have anywhere else to go. So for a long time they survived as best they could. They'd sneak out of the cave to get food and fetch the items they used to brew their spells whenever the troll was out of sight. And whenever they saw him, they'd run back into the darkness. The troll was never smart enough to catch them. And he got angrier and angrier. Soon he started killing animals and leaving them to rot at the mouth of the cave. badgers, foxes, birds. One day he even caught a child from the nearby village and left his tiny, broken body at the cave's entrance. When the witches came out the next day and saw this, they were horrified. But they also spotted something else, something the troll would never have noticed. Stuck amongst the blood and broken remains of the child's body was one thick, black hair. A hair from the head of the troll. And when the witches saw this, they finally knew what to do. They took the hair, they gathered some twigs from the forest, they wove it all together into a miniature wooden doll. They made it tall, fat and ugly, so it looked as much like the troll as possible. They gathered around in their circle and cast their spell. When they were finished with their magic, they got the doll and took turns sticking pins in it. Pin after pin after pin. By the time they were finished, the thing had over 100 sharp sticks of metal peppering its wooden body. The next day, there was no dead animal outside their cave. There was no sign of the troll at all. The witches went looking in the forest, and soon enough, they found black troll's blood staining some ferns by the river. They followed the trail, and the blood got thicker the further along they went, and the stains grew more and more frequent, more and more fresh. Finally, in a clearing not far from the village, they found the troll itself. It was slumped in the shade of a giant oak tree, eyes closed. Pulling in shallow breath after shallow breath, it was bleeding from 100 tiny mouths that had been carved into its green flesh, its black blood leaching out of it in the most slow and painful way imaginable. I remember how Mr. Hanskin stopped the story at this point. He had that familiar scowl on his face as he gestured for the class to be silent. You could tell that everyone had been into the story because a bunch of kids groaned when Hanskin put his hand up to stop. "Yes, yes, okay," he said, holding his hand up for quiet. "I think we've heard enough of that, Grant." "That was particularly unpleasant. I suppose you can take the boy out of the caravan, but you can never take the caravan out of the boy." That wasn't the last day we saw Grant, but it must have been very close. He left our school a couple of weeks later. The family moved away. We heard they went further south, but no one really knows for sure. All that we know is one day Grant was in his lessons, and the next his chair was empty. Gone. Just like that. A few days later, so was Mr. Hanscom. It started when a supply teacher appeared one morning to take his English class. We didn't think much about this at the time, just assumed he was sick or something. It wasn't until we saw the front page of the next day's newspaper. We never found out all of the details. There was talk from the headmaster and whispers in the playground, sure, but mainly a lot of rumours. No one quite knew what to believe. The one thing that everyone could agree on was that Mr. Hanscom had been murdered. Police had no leads, and the details of his death were apparently too grim for the papers to print. I don't know what drove me to go looking for the spot where Grant's family had been camping. Simple curiosity, perhaps. Maybe the fact that I couldn't quite shake the memory of the story he had told. Whatever it was, I spent weeks after Hanscom's murder riding my bike around the local countryside, after school and at weekends, trying to track down their old campsite. And eventually, I found it. It was a man who worked on the newsagents of the edge of a nearby village that gave me the tip, pointed me in the direction of some fields alongside a forest, said that travellers had been staying somewhere over that way. It didn't take me long to find the right field after that. It was close to the edge of the woods, not far from a river. Reminded me a bit of the setting in the story Grant had told. Just swap a cave for a field. I set my bike down and began looking around. Grant's family had been gone a few weeks by this point, but the signs were still there. Flattened patches of grass, a couple of rusted metal chairs, cigarette butts, and, in what I guess must have been the middle of the campsite, a stone circle. I don't know why, but I had a funny feeling in my stomach as I approached the circle. Butterflies, I suppose. Maybe a little bit of fear? The stone circle was empty, but for one thing in the middle. A tiny shape, propped against a rock. I think my mind knew what it was going to be the second before I got close enough to make it out in detail. I drew a sharp breath. The object leaning against the rock was a doll. Wooden, painted, carved out of some nearby tree, I guess. The doll was small, but it had been decorated with careful detail. A little pot belly, thin in hair. I recognised Mr. Hanscombe almost immediately. There was only one thing different. Only one thing that separated the likeness of the doll from the image of Mr. Hanscombe that had appeared in the local newspaper. Something subtly wrong with the face. I leaned closer to get a better look and felt a wave of nausea roll through my stomach. Both of the doll's eyes had been gouged out.
As always, guys, thank you so much for listening, and could you do the usual? Give us a follow, a like, a share on the Instagram, the Twitter, and the Facebook. You know, share the shit out of us to your friends. Give us a like, and please give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. And yeah, if you've got any questions, comments, or concerns, just hit us up with an email at girlstalkcrime@gmail.com. Thank you.
Bye.